He will match 44.
Thank you very much. It's a great pleasure to be here and to talk about HIV positive to positive transplantation today with you. Now, normally, when I look at the audience, I always look at how many people are texting already on their phone or who's already on their email. Now, this morning, I want to ask you to take out your phones and get it ready because I'm actually going to ask you to use your phone and your computers while we are talking in an audience participation vote. So let me give you some background of why I'm talking about HIV positive to positive transplantation and why this is of such interest to me. And before I do that, let me ask you a question about your own experience with HIV positive patients. How many HIV positive patients do you see per month? Do you see more than 20, 10 to 20, 0 to 10, or never? So what you need to do is go into your web browser, put paulf.com/AlmyMiller960 on the web address, and then you will be seeing this question, and you can then answer it. I hope everybody has got a phone. Okay, great. So I'll be asking questions through the course of the talk, and so if you didn't get onto the web browser yet, there will be plenty of opportunity. But we can see from this audience participation that it's not a big problem in the UK. So obviously, this talk perhaps is not that relevant to you, although I'm going to talk later on about why I think it is relevant. But this is what my situation is in South Africa. We have got one of the biggest incidences of HIV in the world, and this map represents more or less how big the problem is in South Africa and in Africa. And if I can give you more scientific numbers, this is based on antenatal clinic data. Now, a lot of problems comes from the fact that we don't have a good data collection system in South Africa, so it's always difficult to give good scientific data from the country. But in antenatal clinics, a lot of people get tested, a lot of women get tested. And we know in that population group, 21% of our population is HIV positive. And the majority of the people who have this disease come from the black population. And one of the problems we have in South Africa is that 84% of South Africans have no medical insurance, and they depend completely on the state health system to get their treatment. Now, we have limited resources in South Africa, and for that 84% of South Africans, we actually cannot provide dialysis to everybody who presents with end-stage renal failure, and this is basically why I started this project. Also, remember that HIV has got a significant impact on the kidney. So we know if there are roughly 1 in 5 HIV-positive people in South Africa, and that person doesn't get antiretroviral therapy, there is about a 20 to a 27% chance that that person might develop renal failure. So that's quite a high incidence of renal disease in that patient group. But even if you get treatment, there is an 8 to 22% chance that you might develop some renal disease as a result of the HIV virus. So it means for every 5 patients in our country who have got HIV disease, there will be one at least that will develop kidney disease. So it's quite a high impact of renal disease in South Africa in this specific population. And that made me think, when I started this program, what can I do to help these patients? Now, At the time when I started the program, these patients were sent home to die. We couldn't dialyze them. There wasn't the option of giving all these patients dialysis. We didn't have the infrastructure. We didn't have the resources. In the state sector, we can only take on about 150 patients in Cape Town in my hospital per year on dialysis. So it means that a lot of people are not able to get dialysis. But you can work, I suppose, on one level to try and increase dialysis slots, but that's tricky. You perhaps get one or two more machines. You don't really help a lot of people by doing that. You can put them into the same organ pool as HIV-negative people and use HIV-negative donors for them, which in many ways is the safest thing to do and what's been happening in the USA and in other parts of the world. But then in our country, where we have such a high prevalence of HIV, one of the solutions to our problem was to start using HIV-positive donors. So one of the things I want to stress is that it's a very context-related decision we made in a specific environment where ethically this decision made a lot of sense. However, I want to ask you again for your opinion and whether you think that if you have an HIV-positive patient, and basically we worry about CD4 counts when we look at them and about viral load, in the long run, for a patient with end-stage renal failure, what do you think will give a higher CD4 count, more control over the virus for a patient with end-stage renal failure? Do you think you would have tried to get more chronic dialysis slots? Do you think you would have gone for transplantation with a HIV-negative donor? Do you think you would have done what I did, rather go for HIV transplantation with a positive donor? Or would you just put them generally on the waiting list for any donors? What would your solution be to this problem? Right. So the USA were faced with that solution, and they decided to use HIV-negative donors in their multi-center trial. And as you might know, if you know the literature, there's been an ongoing project of about, which is now about 5 to 7 years old, using HIV-negative donors in the USA, probably the largest experience with HIV transplantation from Peter Stock. And this is what they have found. The patients who've got HIV, represented in that middle line of their survival, patient and graft survival curves, do almost just as well as the patients who do not have HIV. They somehow fall in the middle between the marginal or older donor group and the completely well group who hasn't got HIV. And so they are represented in that middle line. And that is a fairly good outcome, you would agree. And it doesn't look as if HIV has got such bad results after all. But for me, I wanted to use HIV-positive donors. And for the rest of this talk, I'm going to focus on that. And first, I'm going to tell you about the donors and the selection of donors. And one of the things I would like to stress today is that it's a deceased donor program. So it's not a living-related program. I'm not using HIV-positive people to donate a kidney while they are still alive. It's a deceased donor program. And we've been doing this since 2008. We basically found that we would work up a donor, a brain dead person who gets referred to us. You would normally use HIV antibody titers or P24 antigen to screen for HIV. And we would then find out that this person is positive. And we would then consent the patient as a brain dead donor for an HIV positive recipient. And initially, we were just doing this P24 and HIV antibody screening. But then in March 2013, we had this very interesting case, a 21-year-old female donor with history of drug abuse. She was 8 weeks pregnant, and she presented with an intracranial hemorrhage. She tested negative for HIV-1 and HIV-2 antibodies. She tested negative for P24 antigen, and we used her kidneys and her liver in 4 different recipients. 4 weeks later, all the recipients converted and was HIV positive. So we decided at that point that we should have probably been starting a long time ago to do NAT testing because we have such a high risk in South Africa for HIV. We sent her bloods for NAT testing and retrospectively found that that was also negative. So it's a very interesting case because if you look at the testing for HIV, in that first week after you get the disease, the RNA is the first thing that goes up, which is the one we test when we do NAT testing, but it does take a few days. And basically this donor, the timing of her death was just before that blue line started to go up. But this made us change our policy. So now we are doing NAT testing as well on all our deceased donors. And that has influenced, of course, my study, because where in the past we did HIV antibody differentiation and we did P24 antigen to diagnose these donors, we now have a certain amount of donors who were positive on NAT testing. So you will see in that group on the right-hand side, I've had four donors who tested positive on NAT and who were not confirmed on HIV antibody testing when we diagnosed them. What viral load do you think you would accept for a deceased donor? If you had to make this decision whether a donor is suitable, would you want to have the donor to have an undetectable viral load? Do you think a high viral load if you have a history of what antiretroviral therapy the person was on? Or would you just accept any viral load? And do you think this is important? So this is a very interesting response to me because I asked the same question in the States where they're actually actively debating what donors to use and what the viral load should be. And most of the people in the States only want to use patients who had undetectable viral loads. So in other words, patients who've been treated and who are already determined to be on ARVs and are well looked after already. Where for us in South Africa, we do what you're recommending. We are using any viral load, but we would just like to have an antiretroviral therapy history on the patient. Similarly, I would like to know what CD4 count you would accept in a deceased donor and whether you think that is an important consideration when making a decision about a deceased donor. And once again, we are exactly doing what you guys are responding here. We do not really worry about the CD4 count, especially in the context of brain death, where people's CD4 counts probably go down quite dramatically in any case as a result of the fact that they've had either major trauma or something else that killed them. However, if you are in a developing country like in the States, a lot of people feel that the CD4 count should be above 200 because that reflects how well this person had been looked after. But if you look at my donors, and I have to say, I didn't initially use CD4 count and viral load I didn't think it was important, so I didn't actually even document it in a lot of my donors. But if you look at the ones recently where I started to collect these data, you can see that CD4 counts generally in brain dead donors are quite low. And in my specific patient group, the viral loads are extremely high because they generally are untreated patients who didn't even know that they had HIV before they were diagnosed. But the more worrying thing is the effect of the HIV on the kidney. Now, when I started the talk, I told you that there's a significant risk for the virus to affect your kidney. And if you would pull this through to deceased donors, there is a significant risk that you're transplanting a marginal kidney into a recipient and transplanting somebody who's already got HIVAN. So one of the things we had to think about very carefully is how do we screen for HIV-associated nephropathy in the donor? And it's tricky because a lot of the screening is based on biopsies. And what I find when I look at biopsies, and I'm going to show you biopsies in a little while, is that firstly, sometimes the diagnosis you get when the pathologist reported has got no clinical significance. So they see small little changes, podocyte changes, basement membrane changes, but if you look at the clinical significance of those changes, it's very difficult to correlate those two. Secondly, biopsies need careful interpretation, and you often need quite experienced pathologists to diagnose these very subtle HIVAN changes. And to get that done in a deceased donor in a short period of time before you have to start a transplant often is a problem. So I have selected to use a few things. Proteinuria as a rough screening tool. I wouldn't use a donor whose serum creatinine is very high, where I would expect that there was perhaps a a period where the renal disease had been present. And I try and get as much clinical history as possible. I still do a protocol biopsy in the donors, but I don't make a decision whether I should use that donor based on the biopsy. And I rely on simple things like a urine dipstick and look at the amount of protein urea that the patient has to sort of get an idea of whether they have got previous HIV-associated nephropathy. And basically, if they have an albumin creatinine ratio of less than 30, I think it's very safe and you can easily use this patient and he's got a very low risk of having HIVAN. And then there's this middle group where the albumin creatinine ratio is between 30 and 300 where you can't quite say and where you have to go also on clinical history and you have to get more information if you can, but possibly if you're going to be cautious, you might not use these kidneys. And then high-risk patients where the albumin creatinine ratio is more than 300, where you cannot actually use those kidneys. Another problem when selecting donors is opportunistic infection. Now, once again, this is very regional. So in South Africa, the opportunistic infections that I worry about is mostly tuberculosis. We've got high resistance rates of tuberculosis. I'm showing you on the right-hand side of this slide the South African drug-resistant tuberculosis register, which was published in 2011. You will see that about 80% of patients had multi-drug-resistant TB in South Africa, 80% of our resistant patients, and 19% had extensive drug-resistant TB. So it's a really high incidence. And the outcomes in these patients are really bad. A lot of them die. And what I'm finding is I sometimes get referrals from patients who are dying from a combination of TB and HIV, and I actually decline all those donors, because not because of the HIV, but because of the risk of transplanting resistant TB. Antiretroviral therapy is interesting. In my specific donor group, most of my patients are not on antiretroviral therapy. But when you start taking this work further and you want to debate whether these donors can be used elsewhere in the world, antiretroviral therapy becomes a major concern, because once somebody has been exposed to multiple antiretroviral therapy drugs, the incidence of resistance in that group becomes much higher. And of course, that is a huge problem. If you're going to transplant a kidney with a virus in it that's already resistant to antiretroviral therapy. So in my group of 21 deceased donors, 17 of them had a detectable viral load and were not on antiretroviral therapy, which made it very easy because we know that the virus hasn't been exposed to drug. But four of them had either an undetectable viral load or were diagnosed on NAT. And in those patients, we know that they have been exposed to antiretroviral therapy. And one of the things we are doing now with a research group in the USA is to do a rapid mass spectrometry antiretroviral therapy assay on these people. Now, in South Africa, I can't get that result quick enough to make a decision, so I still make the decisions based on the crude data I showed you in the beginning of the talk. However, I think in the more developed world, this becomes an important tool because the test is very quick and you can see whether the patient had been exposed to antiretroviral therapy. And by having that history, you have so much more information on whether this drug, whether this virus is possibly going to be resistant to further antiretroviral therapy drugs. So this is the donor information in general in my patient group. They're quite young donors. They're mostly coming from the black population. As with all our transplant donors in South Africa, they mostly are trauma cases, and the blood groups are reflective of the South African general population. Now I'm going to show you some information about recipients. So we published this data earlier in the year, and the outcomes in the HIV positive to positive group is actually very good. Patient survival at this stage is about 74% at 5 years. For us, that is compatible to our HIV negative group. And reasons why patients died is mostly related to other infections, but not specifically to the viral flare-up. So I have got a patient who had a reactivation of, I think, TB that he had before, which we didn't pick up at the time of transplant, and he died with respiratory failure immediately after transplant almost. A patient who had severe sepsis, who developed pancreatitis, and died 1 month after the transplant. Then I have got the resistant bugs problem. So I've got a carbapenem resistant Klebsiella pneumonia, which was diagnosed on blood culture, and that patient died 3 months after his transplant. A patient with aspergillosis who died 4 months after the transplant. And then the two long-term deaths are more normal deaths that we see in any population. So these are myocardial infarction and a lung carcinoma. Graft survival also is good at this point, despite all the things we are seeing in some of the biopsies. The actual graft survival is very good, and most patients are off dialysis. And the reasons why grafts fail are mostly related either to drugs or to rejection, chronic rejection. So it can be either that they develop some sort of chronic allograft nephropathy and fibrosis and scarring of the kidney, or they get chronic antibody-mediated rejection in the long run. I'm going to show you some of the histology soon. Another interesting thing in my group is that my patients are not HLA matched. So this is something that in the European setting, in the USA setting, you might match your patients better and for that reason might see less rejection. For me, it's impossible to match HLA. The South African population is very diverse. We cannot really do this for various logistical reasons. And therefore, the risk of rejection probably in my population using Black African donors, Black African recipients where we know rejection rates are higher, plus the fact that we're not matching HLA, is probably why I'm seeing quite a lot of acute and severe rejections. Just to give you an idea of what the HIV-positive recipients look like, generally they are quite young as well. The median age of this patient group is 39. They're mostly Black patients. And I've emphasized on this slide the cause of their renal failure. And the reason why I emphasized this is because I think one of the new things we have to think about in this patient population is the recurrence of HIV-associated nephropathy in the kidney. And this can be on two levels, either from a HIV negative donor or from an HIV positive donor. But we are wondering at the moment whether somebody who had HIVAN in their native kidneys have got a slightly higher risk to also develop HIVAN in their transplanted kidney. And there are a lot of research going on, for instance, on the APOL1 gene, on certain risk factors, why you would be more prone to develop HIVAN if you are on treatment but you have HIV. And we are wondering whether there is a higher recurrence rate in our patient group who had it on their native kidneys. And you can see here that 9 of our patients in the current group had HIVAN, which was biopsy-proven, and in 24 patients, we had no other cause of renal failure, so we're presuming that it was HIVAN, but we are finding, when we look at transplanted kidney biopsies, that there is more subtle HIVAN changes in that specific patient group. We also have to do a few things with these patients. Because they have such high rejection rates, we have to give them quite aggressive antibody induction therapy. And I've been giving everybody either Fresenius ATG or Sanofi thymoglobulin induction therapy because of this very high rejection rates that we've seen in our group as well as in the USA. This does have certain challenges, which I'm going to come to next. The other thing that I would like to stress on this slide is that a lot of patients in my group are on protease inhibitors, and I'm going to talk about some of the drug interactions shortly, which is also a challenge. So let's go to that, drug interactions. And I thought, you know, perhaps we should check you and see how good you are with drug interactions. So my question is, on what dose of tacrolimus would you maintain a 70-kilogram patient who is on a ritonavir-boosted antiretroviral therapy? That's something like Iluvia. How much do you think that patient would need? Would he need quite a small dose, quite a big dose. Okay, so the majority of people think he wouldn't need much tacrolimus. So let me ask a similar patient. He's also on tacrolimus, but this patient is on efavirenz. So he's on quite opposite drug interaction. I'm going to show you now how the drug interactions work. What dose of tacrolimus do you think that patient might need? So the drug interactions is a real challenge, and a lot of the management of these patients have got to do with keeping your eye on those things and making sure they take the drugs regularly and finding the right balance of drug to keep the patient's risk for rejection quite low. And it's based on the cytochrome P450 enzyme interactions. Now, on the left-hand side, you can see what the inhibitors would do. So if you have an inhibitor, a drug that inhibits the enzyme binding site, you can see that inhibitor comes in and it competes with the calcineurin inhibitor at the enzyme binding site. So that is your one scenario. On the right-hand side, you have the inducers. So that drug will come, induce the enzyme binding site, so you'll get more binding sites that could bind to a calcineurin inhibitor like tacrolimus. And in the antiretroviral therapy groups, there are drugs on both sides of this equation. So we have inhibitors on the left-hand side, we have inducers on the right-hand side, and the effect of these things will be quite dramatic. So if you have a protease inhibitor like ritonavir, you will get a five-fold increase in the plasma area under the curve, which basically means that the clearance of the drug will be severely decreased, and you will need a very, very small dose of drug to maintain that patient, so something like 0.5 milligram once a week. On the right-hand side, your other group, where your antiretroviral therapy that is something like efavirenz, you get quite the opposite effect. So you now have inducers for the enzyme binding site. You need a little bit more tacrolimus to get the similar dose. So the cost does go up. The patient needs a much higher dose, and you get a similar or slightly lower even drug level. And to come back to my questions, so the Iluvia group, the protease inhibitors, that patient will need 0.5 milligram once a week. But the second question I asked you, the efavirenz group, that patient will need a higher dose than normal. So that patient will need something like 10 to 12 milligram tacrolimus twice a day. And I have had patients where we ended up with doses like 20 milligrams of tacrolimus twice a day. And because of cost constraints and limited resources, we then elected to switch the patient to a protease inhibitor to try and limit this problem. However, it has got a certain effect. And the effect that we see is to do with my next question. So here is the histology, and I would like you to answer whether you think this is something you would see in an HIV-positive patient who is on Iluvia. And basically, we are seeing the effect of the drug on the histology, and we're seeing some typical changes to do with calcineurin toxicity on that blood vessel. And that's correct. The answer is yes. That is the problem when we have patients on Iluvia. We're seeing quite a dramatic eccentric hyalinosis in the vessel, and for that reason, we have to be careful when we switch patients. The second challenge when we look at CD4 counts and infective risks, because of the thymoglobulin induction therapy, the CD4 count drops dramatically. And here's one of my patients, for instance. She dropped to 2. She then went up to 5. She's struggled for a long time to get a CD4 count back up to a reasonable level. And in that time period, you have to watch them very carefully for infective episodes. But if you look at the overall trend after a few years, they get back to normal and then they do very well. But in that first time, it's very important to screen them for infections. And you can see from my episodes of infection, this is just documenting hospitalized episodes of infection, that they are quite high risk for general bacterial infections. This is something that they need regular follow-up for in clinic as well. We see them in the beginning, we see them once a week. Third challenge that I would like to discuss is the issue about rejection. I think the issue about rejection is very interesting because we don't really know why this is happening. We think that there's a dysregulated immune system in HIV-positive people. And for that reason, they have a much higher incidence than HIV-negative people to get rejection. And here I'm just showing you the amount of rejection episodes I had in my 38 patients. It's quite a significant amount of rejection, a 13% one-year rejection rate, a 30% 2 to 5 year rejection rate, and this is despite using very aggressive induction therapy. So you also see that I've in some of the patients had to give them plasmapheresis and second courses with ATG and thymoglobulin. And then the last challenge, I think, is to do with HIVAN and the recurrence of HIVAN. So a year or two ago, this publication came out from France. They transplanted 19 HIV-positive patients in France. They used HIV-negative donors. And after 3 months, they found that a lot of their patients started to get proteinuria. We're not sure why their incidence is so high. It's much higher than we have in South Africa, and it's also much higher than what's been seen in the USA, but it certainly is very worrying. And they then did PCR on all the patients who had proteinuria and found that there were 68% of them who had detectable HIV in their kidney biopsies. And doing in situ hybridization on that biopsies then showed that in 5 patients, the virus was sitting in the podocyte. In 8 patients, the virus was sitting in the tubular cells. And the patients who had the proteinuria and the nephrotic range of proteinuria and who ended up in the end losing their grafts were the patients who had the virus sitting in their podocytes. So this is something we are also going to do in South Africa now. We want to do laser capsule microscopy on on the biopsies to see exactly where is the virus, but I certainly haven't had this very dramatic recurrence of HIV-associated nephropathy in my group, so I can't really comment on why it's been so huge, such a huge problem in the French group. But I thought it would be fun to see whether you would be able to diagnose HIV-associated nephropathy on a biopsy slide and to check, you know, where you think is the typical microcyst on this histology. There's a typical one. And so far, nobody's got it. That person is right. this is the typical microcyst. I can't click on it, but the big pink blob in the middle. This is what is a very crude manifestation of HIV-associated nephropathy. Unfortunately, it's not always that easy. I'm going to show you some other slides now where the typical microcyst is not that obvious. In 6 patients, we saw some of the minor changes. So fetal glomeruli, podocyte changes, basement membrane changes. In 6 of our patients on protocol biopsy, we see the typical CNI toxicity I showed you in the beginning with the eccentric hyalinosis of the vessels. In 4 patients, we've seen more chronic fibrosis and scarring, which we would roughly call chronic allograft nephropathy. And in 4 patients, we had distinct signs of chronic vascular rejection. So we are seeing issues in these patients. The important thing to take home from it is despite those subtle changes, the difficult histology, the fact that we're seeing abnormal things on some of the slides, like eosinophils, like interstitial fibrosis, and we don't quite know yet what to make of that. I want to stress that all these patients are still off dialysis, and they still have good functioning grafts. So I think it's going to be something we're going to be answering over the next 10 years to see what the true outcome of these kidneys are. And perhaps these kidneys will not last as long as some kidneys in HIV-negative people or from HIV-negative donors. But in the South African context, it still makes a lot of sense to use these kidneys. If you have to give me your biggest challenge using HIV-positive donors, and from what I've told you, I would like to know, what do you think is the biggest challenge? Is it to control the new viral strain? Is it to manage the recipient while the CD4 count is so low? Is it the screening of the donor for the inherent kidney disease? Is it the acute rejection? Or do you think using these HIV-positive donors and transplanting these patients is probably not such a big challenge and could probably easily be done? So because of these questions, because we don't really know the answers to a lot of it, I'm just going to show you some of the virology and immunology work that we're currently driving. We are looking for superinfection. We are sequencing the virus now in all donors, in all recipients, and then as the time goes by. The truth is nobody in my patient group had a flare-up of viral load, so the new viral strain certainly hasn't been a big problem. But we have to prove this, and for that reason, we are doing these sequencing and compartmentalization studies to look for the virus in all these different samples and to see whether the virus is changing, whether the nature of the virus is changing after we introduce this new viral strain. So we're working with this at the moment, doing some PCR and some DD droplet PCR. And then in terms of the rejection, we are also now looking in more detail at the CD4, CD8 ratios, at the different T regulatory cells, to see whether there's some way how we can explain the high rejection rates in this patient group, why we are seeing such a lot of problems with rejection in this patient group. So these things are ongoing things that we are trying now to address, and hopefully we'll have more answers over the next 5 to 10 years about this. So the topic of my talk was changing policies around the world. I think a lot of people are now trying to change their policies to use HIV-positive donors. It doesn't make sense to let this resource go down, even if it's just a small amount of donors that could be used. Possibly it could change outcome for some recipients. In the USA, they've now accepted what they call the HOPE Act. So they're hoping to start with a positive-to-positive program early in the new year. And they want to use positive donors in controlled circumstances. It's certainly been debated in Europe. I've just been at the Eurotransplant meeting where I know there are some people who would like to start using HIV-positive donors. I asked the question in Europe whether they would like, whether they think after this talk, that HIV-positive donors should be used, and that was the answer. 63% of people in the audience felt that they would like to use HIV-positive donors. And I thought, let's hear what the people in Oxford think. So do you think HIV-positive donors should be considered in the UK? We're waiting for some no's. So it's certainly, as I said in the beginning of the talk, it's about context. It's about where you work. It's about treatment options for patients. Situations are different in different places. And, you know, obviously that affects how you make policies and how you make decisions. Just a quick thank you to the people in my team. Any comments, I'll be happy to respond to any questions, or if you want to put a comment on the screen. Thank you.